You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, June 23, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at the University of Mississippi, Garrett Felber. On Those Who Know, Don't Say, the Nation of Islam, the Black Freedom Movement, and the carceral state. Meanwhile, key primaries for progressives in New York and Kentucky. Corona cases rising in well over a dozen states as Trump's White House looks to scapegoat the CDC. The House Judiciary Committee announces it's going to subpoena Bill Barr over his bungled Friday night massacre, among other things. And police in D.C. thwart, sadly, an Andrew Jackson toppling as the White House locks down. Still no word as to whether Bunker Boy headed to the bunker. On the Hill, Fauci, Redfield, Hahn, and the hydroxy doctor will testify to a Democratic House committee meeting hearing. Meanwhile, Democrats in the Senate threaten to block a Republican weak tea police reform bill. Trump slams the door on skilled immigrants. And Martha McSally, so desperate, she proposes giving wealthy people more money. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. We will start off today by reading a fan email. Maybe not a fan. I don't know. It is. We received it yesterday at about 4:45 p.m. from Tim. I'm not going to use his last name. Sam Steeder shouldn't have shaved his mustache. All the best, Tim. That was it. So I just wanted to get that out of the way.
That's prevailing sentiment, I think.
Is that right? Seriously?
Yesterday the chat went so crazy when you first appeared that I thought the stream went down.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm sorry about that, folks. Maybe for a special occasion, I will regrow the mustache.
We could take a Twitter poll maybe too.
We could take a Twitter poll. I mean, these are the important issues that we really, really need to deal with. Welcome to the program. Just another day during a pandemic where we are starting to see the implications of Memorial Day, essentially, a little more than 2 weeks ago, rises in infections and in hospitalizations. States like Arizona, Texas is now starting to get a little worried. Also, Oklahoma and Oregon, California. In fact, it's rising in about 16 states across the country significantly, and of course, picking up the pace. Now, the interesting dynamic that's going on here is that while we have seen a rise in infections and a nearly commensurate rise, nearly, in hospitalizations, we have seen nowhere near the rise in deaths that we saw, let's say, in New York City. And there's speculation only at this point because people don't know for sure. Obviously, we don't have time to get the we don't have enough hindsight yet to get the data, but it appears to be because the average age for people being infected is significantly lower than it was in New York. Probably represents 20 and 30 year olds going to bars, frankly, in many cases in places like Arizona and Texas and following the during Memorial Day and subsequent to that as well. Part of it also may be a function of just the hospitals, the doctors treating patients have more savvy now than they did two or three months ago because of the experience that people had two or three months ago. Obviously, theoretically, we're getting better at treating people who have contracted the virus. And there may be some other, you know, some medicines and therapies that are working better as well. So it's a combination of those things. However, we will, I think, see a rise there, and hopefully it won't be nearly as steep as the infection rate will be. And hopefully we do not get to a place, and I suspect it's possible that in localized situations in some of these states, we may get to a place where the capacity to treat people essentially runs out, where there's just, you know, only so many beds. We mentioned yesterday that DeSantis in Florida decided to stop reporting number of ICU patients and report only those patients that need critical care. ICU is intensive care. I guess maybe there's a slight difference. I don't know. But it's going up. It's not going to go away. And hopefully there isn't I don't know. I guess the big question is, what happens if it really expands at a rate faster than it was in New York amongst younger people? At one point, does that start to crush across a threshold? I guess we will see, because there does not seem to be any type of plan whatsoever to deal with any of this. The only thing it appears that the White House is doing is they are starting to game out a situation where they blame the CDC. So there it is. Donald Trump is very angry these days, apparently, because he embarrassed himself the other day in Oklahoma. And we're starting to see these stories about how he's really mad at Brad Parscale, who is the campaign manager for the Trump campaign. I suspect these are, it may in fact be the case, but I suspect that he's not going anywhere, because he's basically overseeing a slush fund. And you don't necessarily want the guy who's been signing checks on the slush fund to be cut loose, particularly this early.
Parcell was the one that Trump wanted to sue for giving him bad poll results about a month ago.
Hmm. I wonder if you can actually, if that's actionable. If you guys give me bad YouTube numbers, just be aware that I may come after you. Folks, I think you probably have come across the dynamic where small changes in your everyday life can lead to positive lifestyle changes. I remember when I first, and I think it was because I was inspired by Tim Ferriss, if you can believe it, I think, to start making my bed every day, like actually make it, you know, nicely. And part of the inspiration for that was, frankly, my Brooklinen sheets. And I found that after I made my bed, I'd started to organize my room a lot more. Because I don't know if people are aware of this, but I like a little bit of chaos in front of me at all times, because it makes me feel like I'm calm. But not only can making your bed set you on the right path, things like changing your towels can make your bathroom feel like a spa, wearing certain loungewear can turn function into luxury. And you can make all of these upgrades, like I say, with Brooklinen. Hopefully by now you know that Brooklinen is the internet's favorite sheets, but they're also home to bedding, loungewear, towels with more than over 50,000 five-star reviews and counting. Now they have everything for life essentials, including shower curtains, bath mats, robes, totes, the final details that make your big upgrade. I love the sheets, folks, and I'm starting to zero in on some towels from Brooklinen. My experience with Brooklinen sheets has been really fantastic. I am now almost 100% Brooklinen. And I'm just, you know, I can't bring myself to throw out the old nasty sheets, all of them, but I'm going to. I've been really happy, and now I'm starting to look at my towels. Brooklinen has some, and they have, you know, three different, I think, tiers of towels, like the really luxurious ones, the sort of the classic ones, and then these ones that are lighter that dry very quickly. I tend to go with the classic on everything, but Brooklinen.com, it's the perfect place to start making these small changes that end up making big differences. Brooklinen is so confident in their products that all their sheets, all their comforters, their loungewear, their towels, they come with a lifetime warranty. Go on, folks. Make yourself comfortable. Get 10% off your first order and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY only at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life. We will put a link to Brooklinen.com and a reminder that the promo code is MAJORITY in our podcast description and our YouTube description. All right. So, you know, we have this situation where, for the most part, there's still a tremendous amount of denial out there as to the implications of COVID-19. And however, in Arizona, the good news is that apparently you can still go to your local mega church if you go to the Dream City Church in Phoenix, because they have... Not only are they, you know, hosting the services and, I imagine doing other things at that mega church, but they also have invented devices to kill most of the coronavirus. Who knew?
COVID-19 here at Dream City Church. We're probably the first church in the nation to...
Yeah, we've installed Clean Air EXP. We have a local Arizona company. It was technology developed by some members of our church, and we've installed these units, and it kills 99.9% of COVID within 10 minutes from independent testing.
It's an ionization? Is that what
ionization. It's ionization of the air, and it takes particulates out, and COVID cannot live in that environment.
So when you come into our auditorium, 99% of COVID is gone, killed, if it was there in the first place. So you can know when you come here, you'll be safe and protected. Thank God for great technology, and thank God for being proactive.
Amen.
Bless you guys.
Yeah, now, I don't know. This is the church that it is, that is hosting Donald Trump for his rally. And they may be a little bit concerned based upon what happened in Oklahoma that nobody's going to show up. But now they're promising that they have something that will kill 99.9% of COVID-19. Now,
you'd like to get that to 100, but.
Well, that's the thing is that, I'm in no position to assess their claim. I'm a little skeptical, but apparently, I mean, there is, you know, according to some, that plasma air ionization reduces coronavirus. But then the question is 99.9, is that enough to reduce it, to make it safe for people to go in there? I mean, I guess that's, people are going to take... We're going to roll the dice. But that's quite a coincidence that the church that is hosting Donald Trump has come up with a special machine to kill all the coronavirus in the church.
Necessity is the mother of invention, Sam.
Boom. Boom. All right. Well, good luck. And I mean, I would pray for you, but I'm not sure that I'm hitting all the right, you know, I don't know that my prayers hit that target. The don't catch coronavirus in the Trump rally in a church target. But if it does, good luck. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to professor of history at University of Mississippi, Garrett Felbert, on his book, Those Who Know Don't Say, The Nation of Islam, The Black Freedom Movement, and the Carceral State. Quick break. Be right back. Okay, we are back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program professor of history at the University of Mississippi, author of Those Who Know Don't Say, The Nation of Islam, The Black Freedom Movement, and The Carceral State, Professor Garrett Felbert. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Sam.
So let's start with, I mean, one of the things I like about the title of your book is it really does, cover it, but it also raises a question in many respects, but let's just start with, Those Who Know Don't Say. Where is that, what does that refer to?
So that title comes from a phrase that Muslims in the Nation of Islam would use when asked about their political engagement. So they would say, those who say don't know and those who know don't say. So the idea there was sort of that they were engaged in a politics that was strategic and often hidden from view. And then, you know, sort of the second half of that phrase, which is that those who were saying they sort of understood the Nation of Islam often were outsiders. So I chose that title. It is a little obscure in a way that I hope draws people in, because really that was the sort of challenge of the book for me, was to try and show the ways that people might think the Nation of Islam was not politically engaged during the Black Freedom Movement, but how it sort of did so strategically and often silently.
So what was the specific political agenda of the Nation of Islam that it was both doing strategically and, I guess, to a certain extent, maybe surreptitiously is a little overstated, but in a low-key fashion?
Yeah, so, I mean, for people who don't know, the Nation of Islam was a black nationalist religious organization. So, you know, they were committed to building a black nation within the United States. They didn't see themselves as citizens of the U.S. But in part because of the way that the state tried to repress the organization, they had to be really thoughtful about how they positioned their politics. So the majority of the men in the organization were incarcerated during World War II, charged with sedition for refusing to serve in the war, in part because they, as I said, they didn't see themselves as citizens. So pretty much thereafter, they were surveilled by the FBI, infiltrated by local and state police. And the state really tries to make this argument that the Nation of Islam is a hate group and that they're not, in fact, sincere in their religious beliefs, and that the sort of larger Muslim world rejects them. And so they were sort of always positioned in a way by the state repression to have to make arguments of religious legitimacy, of not being political, because to be political was often to be framed by the state as a hate group, and lots of civil rights organizations, sort of mainstream civil rights organizations, started characterizing them, especially in the 60s, as nothing but a example of a black KKK or reverse racism or black hate. So they were sort of pigeonholed in this way that they had to be very strategic about when they said that they were doing political work.
I want to put a pin in that aspect of how the sort of the, I guess the, what you would call the mainstream black rights organizations were attempting to sort of, characterize the Nation of Islam. But let's, talk about the relationship between the, I guess in some ways, the prison abolition movement, the relationship to the carceral state was sort of born out of this dynamic.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people don't necessarily know how influential the Nation of Islam was in terms of organizing inside prison. So pretty much from this moment in the mid-1940s, when Elijah Muhammad and other ministers, about 100 or so, constitute the largest number of black conscientious objectors during the war. And they go to prison and actually meet abolitionists. And there, those abolitionists are largely associated with the Friends, the Quakers. So they don't necessarily become abolitionists per se, but they're sort of part of this radical political scene in the 1940s. And it begins this long-term relationship with sort of organizing within prisons. And it's actually through the Nation of Islam's prison litigation, in the late 50s and early 60s that prisoners for the first time get constitutional rights. So prior to that, incarcerated people were considered slaves of the state according to the Constitution. And the judicial branch essentially sees incarcerated people as solely within the purview of corrections. It's not something that they weigh in on. So it's really not until the mid-1960s with a case out of Illinois by a Muslim named Thomas Cooper that incarcerated people have undeniably constitutional rights. And that sort of opens the door for what we see as the prisoners' rights movement. And then out of that, of course, this long strain of abolition.
Explain to us what this this term that you call dialectics of discipline is. I guess it's a phrase.
Yeah, so it's, you know, I was trying to capture what I was seeing in the archive, which was really a dynamic between state repression and Muslim resistance. And I kept trying to, it was sort of a chicken or the egg thing, where I would see some sort of organized resistance by incarcerated Muslims, and then the state would sort of put a rule in place or do some sort of thing to counteract that. And then they would come up with some new form of organizing in response. And I just sort of kept tracing it back and back and back and realized, well, this isn't linear. This is really the nature of political organizing. It's dialectical. It always happens in relationship to the repression the state's doing. And so that's the dialectical part. The discipline part was kind of understanding that there's various forms of discipline. There's the state discipline, which is about coercion and repression. And then there's sort of collective and personal discipline, which was shown by Muslims in the Nation. So they would do all these things that, you know, whether it was prayer or dress or refusing to, you know, do drugs or curse. But even at one point, taking over solitary confinement. So they would purposely commit infractions to go to solitary confinement. And the idea was that they would take over solitary to the point where it actually became an ineffective means of punishment. So I started to see the relationship between their sort of collective discipline to do something like that and receive the state's idea of discipline, of punishment.
So how would they take over solitary? Like what would be the implications? Just that because they're attempting to do that, they're sending a message that this is an ineffective punishment, or what was the theory behind that?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about the takeover of the solitary is that it coincides with something that we traditionally see as a civil rights movement strategy, which is jail, no bail. So at the exact same time that in Albany, Georgia, student protesters were realizing that instead of, you know, doing nonviolent resistance, getting arrested, and then having to pay bail, which is incredibly expensive and laborious, that they would just refuse to pay bail and fill the jail. And then they would have to figure out, well, now we're jailing massive numbers of people that we can't hold. And this strategy, it's not necessarily that one informed the other, but it was sort of going on at the same time at Attica in New York. The idea was essentially, look, they only have so many solitary cells. And what they're doing is they're pulling us in and out of solitary one by one. And that disrupts organizing because one person's in solitary, one's in general population, they can't communicate. And they decided, well, if we all just force them to hold us in solitary, then they can't put anyone else there for other disciplinary interactions. We're all there organizing. So it sort of turns the site of repression on its head and makes it a site of resistance. So I think there was an interesting parallel where they were sort of doing a similar thing that the civil rights movement was doing. And I think it raises an interesting question, which is, you know, why do we remember Albany, Georgia in the annals of civil rights history? And this strategy at Attica is completely forgotten.
Well, why is that?
I mean, I think it speaks to the invisibility of incarcerated organizing, right? So, I mean, we do have these moments of eruption like Attica in 1971, but this is Attica in 1961. So this organizing is always happening inside prisons, but it's largely invisible in part because of the nature of prisons. Prisons are to forcibly disappear people from our society. So this organizing that happens all the time, it's sort of like the organizing in the streets, right? We have these uprisings now, but they didn't come out of nowhere. They come out of years and decades of organizing. So Attica in 1971 comes out of the long tradition of organizing a decade earlier.
How much of, I mean, is that the, when you look at the role of the Nation of Islam in these movements, is their influence through the years tactical, or were there elements of ideological that also crossed over into the broader Black freedom movement?
I mean, I think there's all sorts of ways that we see evidence of the Nation of Islam in movements and don't often credit it. I mean, both in terms of cultural and sort of Black pride, in hip hop, in all these forms. I mean, the one that I was really trying to pull out in this book was specifically that so often we focus on particular charismatic figures within the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, Muhammad Ali, and we kind of look at this national level. And it's about what is the relationship between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, or what is Malcolm saying, and then what is Roy Wilkins with the NAACP saying? And what we miss is that there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are part of this movement on the ground or in prison who are organizing locally. So, you know, I looked at in LA where there's this coalition against police brutality after a Muslim man is shot in Los Angeles in 1962. And the NAACP is working with the Nation of Islam locally. And it's only at the national level where they really start to have issues with this. So I think it really shows how when we just look at the national level, we miss all sorts of ways that there are coalitions happening on the ground.
How much of what we're seeing today in terms of Black Lives Matter, in terms of, I guess, the defund police movement and the abolition of prisons movement, how much is where is the Nation of Islam's influence the most prominent, would you say?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's throughout the movement, and it's not necessarily, I mean, one of the things that I think is important about this moment is actually many of the ways that the organizing pushes against some of the tendencies of the Nation of Islam, right? Like the masculinism, you know, the sort of top-down leadership. I mean, the movement now is being led by queer Black women, trans folks. It's decentralized. So I think in some ways there's a lot of organizing the streets that's happening out of the lessons of that moment in the 60s that I write about. But I still think there's a huge strain in terms of prison organizing that the Nation of Islam is responsible for, and the coalitional work against police. Like I mentioned in the early 60s, they had a more radical critique of policing than some of these mainstream civil rights organizations, in part because they were the ones who were most susceptible to it. They were, you know, being infiltrated and brutalized and having their mosques raided. So I think they had a more acute sense of the state violence that was happening at that time.
I mean, is that where, and I guess that gets back to the dialectics of discipline on some level, but I mean, is that where is that the genesis of this movement? Was a function of being on the, you know, specifically the Nation of Islam being on that end of things, or was there an ongoing movement that was then sort of joined?
Yeah, I don't think we can take any sort of one genesis point, for all of this, but there was such a shift between the early 60s where basically the Nation of Islam was the vanguard, within prison organizing spaces to even, 10 years later where at Attica in 1971, you have the Young Lords Party, you have the Black Panthers, you have the Nation of Islam, and these groups all have different sort of ideological analyses, organizing strategies. So there was a huge shift, even in that 10-year period where, the Nation of Islam clearly has a huge impact on something like the Black Panthers. I mean, if you look at the Black Panther 10-point program, it's almost identical to the Nation of Islam's what we want, what we believe. But there's, of course, a whole different set of strategies and analysis that the Panthers have that the Nation of Islam didn't. So, there's never just sort of a one clear line, but all these movements, I think, build on one another and also often build on the sort of weaknesses of these organizations. So when an organization excludes people, like SNCC excluding women leads to the establishment of a group like the Third World Women's Alliance. So I think it's important to think about some of the shortcomings of these organizations as being beneficial as well.
Tell us about the journey of reconciliation. This is, I wasn't really familiar with this, and Bayard Rustin was one of the people, who was involved in that.
Yeah. So this is something I was really interested in, this kind of group of abolitionists that I talked about earlier. So the journey of reconciliation is sort of known as the first Freedom Ride. So we often think of the Freedom Rides of 1961, of students coming down to the South on buses, being jailed at Parchman Farm. And the journey of reconciliation in 1947 was sort of the first iteration of this. It was half Black men, half white men. And the idea was to challenge the recent ruling in the Supreme Court about desegregated interstate travel. But the sort of point that I bring out in this piece that I just wrote recently is that these organizers who are sort of seen as participating in one of the real first desegregation, nonviolent desegregation struggles of the civil rights movement were also part of this network of prison abolitionists who had spent time during World War II with the likes of Elijah Muhammad and others in federal prisons for refusing the draft. So I think there's just all these ways that these movements really, I often sort of bristle at when someone says like, oh, the civil rights movement of our time is mass incarceration. It's like, state violence has always been the thing that people are struggling against in these movements because it's the repressive arm of the state. Policing and prisons are always the thing that people are dealing with who are organizing for liberation.
We talk a little bit about the role of the more, so-called mainstream Black advocacy groups, during this time and how they set themselves apart from the Nation of Islam and for what purpose?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated because in part what happens, really, these groups tend to not comment on the Nation of Islam at all until 1959. And in 1959, there's this documentary by Mike Wallace, later of 60 Minutes, called The Hate That Hate Produced. And what they do is they ask people like Roy Wilkins and Anna Arnold Hedgman, and they sort of ask them to weigh in on what they're calling the rise of Black supremacy. the Nation of Islam. So they've already framed the Nation of Islam's black nationalism through this idea of it somehow being the opposite of white supremacy. And, you know, these civil rights organizations then denounce the Nation of Islam. The year shortly thereafter, the NAACP actually offers a formal resolution at its national convention denouncing the Nation of Islam. And eventually, when there's these coalitions that I mentioned at the local level against police brutality, they even have this really fine point plan that local NAACP leaders have to follow when organizing with the Nation of Islam. They can't say that they're forming a united front. They can't let any speakers be at the rallies. So, you know, there's this real division between these sort of mainstream civil rights organizations and the Nation of Islam. And of course, part of it's ideological. They have different ideas about what racism and capitalism in the United States means, but also it's sort of fomented by these white liberals who sort of, you know, drive this wedge between local organizers.
And it was just found to be, they just quickly made them toxic on some level and sort of forced, I guess, these other organizations into a less militant disposition. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, just to give a concrete example. So in Los Angeles, there's this murder that I mentioned. And for a couple of months in 62, after this murder, there's a Black United Front in Los Angeles. And Malcolm gives a speech where he says, you know, you're not brutalized because you're Baptist or Methodist. You're not brutalized because you're an Elk or a Mason. You're brutalized because you're Black. And it's this call to sort of understand policing at its root as anti-Black. And this coalition starts building. And the first thing that, you know, the chief of police and the mayor try to do is to divide Black groups. And there's this recognition that that's what they're trying to do. And then after a couple of months, 100 Christian ministers sign something called the Minister's Manifesto. And what they try to do is both denounce police brutality on one hand, while also calling the Nation of Islam anti-God, and sort of this fringe group. So I think we have to recognize the way that the white power structure knows that dividing these groups is effective, but also the deep Islamophobia within communities that was kind of driving this feeling of pushing them to the side.
When you look at, like, you know, what has taken place, I mean, you know, this obviously, in many respects, I mean, there's been really years that have led up to the past month, let's say. But in the past month, there has been, as far as I can tell, the most dramatic movement that we've seen, at least in terms of like public perception of these questions, and you know, some response on a political level. I mean, I think it's easy to overstate it, but I think at least in terms of public sentiment, things have changed, and maybe have hit some type of critical mass. It just strikes me that there is an absence of arrows in the quiver, as it were, for the response to these movements outside of, you know, I mean, there seems to be, like, you know, there's some of the co-opting, there's co-optation on some level, right? Like, where corporations are now, you know, are sort of like showing some type of solidarity. But the only other response apparently or appears to be just a violent police response, which doesn't seem to be terribly effective in terms of public opinion. But there isn't this sort of, this quiver full of arrows of dividing and conquering, because there doesn't seem to be the same seams that existed at that time. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think, no, it makes a ton of sense. And I think there's both reason for optimism and for, you know, to be vigilant. And the optimism is that the same thing. So, you know, when Stokes is killed in 1962, the LA Times and the mainstream white press say this was a blazing gunfight and a riot. And the only people who can dispute that is the Nation of Islam. And they do it through their press and Muhammad speaks. But, you know, we have the benefit now of people can watch videos and just say, look, whatever the press is saying, whatever the police are saying, I can see this just isn't true. So I think we have the benefit now of not having to fight on those fronts as much, where people can actually see the violence happening in the streets every day rather than relying on these sources who are, you know, frankly, completely complicit. But I think the quiver or the arrow that is a almost seamless, you know, 50-60 year magic bullet for counterinsurgency and co-optation is reform. So this case in LA, I mean, LA was being heralded as, you know, the most professional, modernized police force when this happened. And then this led to Watts. And then again, it was like, oh, we'll give them SWAT teams and this and that, and it'll be the most professionalized, reformed. We'll do citizen review boards and speakers bureaus. That's always the call, is reform. And I think, you know, the reason I'm optimistic in this moment is because a lot of people are finally, we've done the political education work for people to know that that's not the answer. That's actually the same thing that they've been trotting out since the beginning. But that's the thing that I think is poised to be the most, you know, co-optive or, you know, sort of counterinsurgent in this moment is reform.
So you think the you know, like when we talk about maybe the bill that's going in Congress, or I mean, certainly the Obama administration had instituted a program that the Minneapolis Police Department was one of the, you know, I guess the pilot, the test cases of this extensive reform project, and it failed. And so the most prominent arrow you're suggesting is in fact something that co-opts the energy and really doesn't end up doing anything.
Yeah, I mean, the number one thing you'll see, right, in all of these cases is a report. So they'll fund a ton of money into a report to tell us what we already know. I mean, this is what they did with Watts and Detroit, and, you know, and then the Kerner Commission report comes out, and guess what? Even when the Kerner Commission told them what was wrong, they selectively listened to what they wanted to hear and what they didn't, and they wound up giving more money to police. You know, so what they'll do is they'll sort of filibuster for a couple of years by getting this report. And if it's anything like Ferguson, I mean, you know, the report is damning, but it doesn't mean that results in actual change. It gets people out of the streets and it waits for things to quell. And the other thing that they'll do is they'll pour money back into police departments and say, you all need to do bias training or, you know, purchase more whatever. And it's like, that's why the defund the police, I mean, it means what it asks, right? Or what it demands. It's saying stop giving money to police to reform themselves and take that money and invest it in Black and brown communities. So we have to be vigilant about that, because what both sides of the aisle are going to say is that we need more money for police. We just need it to do different things. And that's absolutely not what we need.
And so how does that, I mean, I guess the A, I'm asking maybe something outside of your project, but, or this immediate project. But let me ask it in including are there lessons, that you have found that may be instructive, or, any other ideas about what that vigilance looks like? I mean, in the moment when you have police and scenes of police being this brutal, or in the wake of a video showing, a policeman murdering somebody in front of our eyes, essentially, protests and clashes with the police drive sympathy and sort of like some measure of solidarity from the broader society, not totally, but to some extent, and at least meaningful enough. But if you don't have those predicates, how do you maintain that vigilance?
I mean, I think the thing that has to always be there, and this is why I sort of mentioned like long form, when you draw a line and you say, no, this is just a constant struggle, is the political education for people to understand. Because people, when we see George Floyd being murdered, some people see a bad apple, and that's reformable. And some people see an example of a structure that needs to be abolished. And we need to keep people's eyes on the prize. I mean, one of the things I love, a good comrade, Derica Purnell, said, you know, is the justice that we're seeking, say with these reforms being proposed of banning chokeholds or excessive force, is the thing that we call justice, George Floyd, you know, having his neck under someone's knee for 7 minutes? Is it him being arrested and then thrown in jail and then, you know, put through this churn of what we call mass incarceration? No, that can't be justice. So we have to think about the things that we see that are sickening and link them to larger structures. Because otherwise, we're just going to keep tinkering and trimming bushes and thinking that this is just about exceptional violence. It's not. It's about the everyday violence of the system. The whole system relies on the possibility of fatal force. That's how policing works, is that at any moment, you could be murdered by the police, and that they will have absolute impunity. So that's, the police relies on violence. And we have to understand that and be vigilant about abolishing those systems and not giving those systems any more of our money.
Gary Felber, the book is Those Who Know Don't Say, The Nation of Islam, The Black Freedom Movement, and The Carceral State. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break in just a moment, head into the fun half of the program. Let me remind you, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you're supporting the free show. You're getting extra content. Maybe you're encouraging me to regrow my mustache. I'm not going to promise anything, but it's possible. I may feel more whimsical if we get a bunch of new members, and then I just may let it grow. I'm not sure. I'm not going to promise anything. But head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. Become a member today. Support the program. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We have merch. We got a special initiative that we're going to do. And let me just introduce that now, just a little bit. This is a little bit of a taste. I'm not even going to put it in context as to what we're talking about. But here it is. And this is, so let you know what we got going on.
I'm losing it, bro.
That's right. I'm not even going to tell you what that means. But, you know, what do they say all the time in broadcasting? Keep your ears on this space, and we will let you know what's happening there. Also, don't forget the AM quickie. Oh, you can go to, speaking of merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. shop.majorityreportradio.com. Also, AM Quickie, sign up for that bad boy. Get your 6 or 7 minutes every day. Podcast, totally free. Headlines, check it out. Matt, who today? Oh, today's Tuesday. Who's on TMBS tonight?
We got Ronan Burtonshaw of the Tribune, which is George Orwell's former paper, and William Shockey, who will be talking about the ANC Capitol and policing.
There you go. You can find The Michael Brooks Show on YouTube at youtube.com/The Michael Brooks Show. You can also find it at patreon.com/TMBS/TMBS. Check that out. Do we have Nomi? Is she with us?
Not yet.
Not yet. I'll send her the...
All right. Well, don't forget the Nomi Key Show. You can find it on patreon.com/The Nomi Key Show. And also on youtube.com, The Nomi Key Show. And tonight, actually, I believe she's going to tell us when she gets here. She is doing some coverage of the New York primaries. We're going to talk about that quite a bit in the fun half today. Nomi knows New York state politics. And this is a big deal. this primary is a big deal. I know a lot of people around the country are like, why do I care about New York 16th? Jamal Bowman, and I encourage you, obviously, if you're in New York and you haven't voted, particularly if you're in one of these districts, you got to go out and vote, folks. You got to go out and vote. Put a mask on. Go away, you know, 6 feet. It is, it's really important. Nomi will talk more about this. Oh, here she is.
Hello. I was having some issues with my audio. Gosh.
What do you got on your, stickers on your computer?
You can see them.
Other shows.
Oh my God. Those are from,
we got to get,
give me some stickers. Well, I'll rip that TYT stuff off.
The merch stuff. I was just saying, Nomi, that, are you going to be doing a live thing tonight?
I am. How funny you ask. Yes, tonight at 7:30 Eastern, we start our live streaming covering the New York primary, which, spoiler alert, we may not know many of the results tonight, tomorrow, the day after that, maybe several days. But we'll have a lot of people on who work in New York politics and some of our congressional challenger candidates that are running around the city talking about the dynamics of what's happening, you know, what's happening with the New York machine. Does it still exist? What are the machines? There's a lot happening. I know everyone's paying attention to Jamal Bowman, but there's some really interesting races.
I want to hear about them a little bit more, but you got to turn your mic down a little bit. Apparently today it's super hot, I've been told.
Is this better?
Matt?
No, not really.
Oh, whoa.
Guys.
What's going on?
I don't know.
Right, it's maybe a little bit better.
It might
adjust it a little bit, yeah.
Is that better?
I think so. I think we're getting there.
Okay. Yeah, okay, that's good.
I apologize, guys, for blasting your eardrums.
Well, we'll talk about those races. But I think the Bowman race is huge. Particularly because there's expectations there now, but it's also like one more member of the House leadership getting knocked out of the box. That's good, and it's gonna send a message that this stuff has not been, this is not fluke, this is not a fluke, this is for reals, and you either get with the program or you shove off. We had AOC on the program on Friday, and she was talking like, she was saying 10, 15 more folks like this, and we'll have some real momentum. And part of the problem, too, and I had heard this before, but she reminded us of it, and we'll talk about this in the fun half, but I think it's time for the CPC to have like a little bit of a litmus test.
Yeah.
But we'll talk more about that in a bit.
You mean not just hashtag
what's happening? So you're doing this live stream tonight, and then what else? What else do you have for the show this week?
Yeah, so this week we, in full transparency, we had some technical issues. I'm not one to believe in Mercury in retrograde, but I definitely believe in it after this weekend. The sound
is Mercury in retrograde right
it
now.
It is, and literally everything in my life has between the internet going out, which is just a thing yesterday, the microphone just now, to recording an entire show and then not having it save, even though it says it's recording. So I had to do some quick shifts. So the show's a little late. It's a really good show this week. We have Asan Lakey, who's running for Congress in Massachusetts. She's a matriarch candidate. It's the 4th district. That's Joe Kennedy's seat. Fascinating race. Lots of people running. Her story is, I knew a lot about her story, and then she really opened up, and I was blown away just by the kind of oppression she faced in Morocco, where she comes from, and just how that lines up with this moment here in the United States. And then we have Ben Dixon on, where we're talking about the uprisings and just the movements on the ground, and he's just been so on fire lately, and I think I would watch, I mean, if you're not already watching Ben's show, I think something's happening there. Like, he's becoming a very big voice in this movement. Just watching very closely online, especially. So it's a good interview. But the show tonight is going to be, I mean, if you don't know anything about New York politics, if you live in New York, I would definitely recommend watching this, because we're going to dive in and assess. And these are, you know, a lot of the folks that we're having on are folks who are doing the movement work, but we don't really have a vibrant media in New York, despite it being the media capital of the world. And so I'm surprised by, I mean, just right now I got some texts from people who are super tapped in nationally, live in New York, and they're like, wait, what's going on? I'm so confused. Can you explain all this stuff? So,
without a doubt. And I will say this, for a national audience, the thing that's important about New York politics, it seems to me, and I think I'm becoming more and more clear on this, is that the model that a guy like Cuomo uses, the model that a guy like Schumer uses, and I mean, there is an element of like, there's a little bit of corruption in New York state politics, very transactional corruption. But the model that they use is I want, and I will actually work towards having enough people to my right.
Yes.
Get elected so that I don't have, so that I can project that I'm more progressive than I am. And can basically look towards my constituents are saying, why aren't we getting X, Y, and Z? Yeah. And I go, it's because of these guys. Yeah. And I'm the guy who helped those guys in. So it's Chuck Schumer, you know, like supporting Amy McGrath in Kentucky, or Hickenlooper in Colorado, you know, and as opposed to progressives in an area where they have just as good a chance of winning.
Yeah.
Maybe in some instances better. I mean, if you believe the polling, than the conservative or the, you know, Democrat essentially. And, you know, people now know that Cuomo did this with the IDC. And I think in many respects, the Congress people that we have in New York who have been in leadership positions in the Democratic Party have also functioned in some way to provide cover for the lack of sort of leaning into by the Democrats.
Yeah.
Because if these guys are doing it, you know, and they're in New York and they're in a safe blue seat, then, you know, of course, the marginal district, the, you know, plus five Democrats, they can't be expected to vote for this measure. So there's
crazy.
A lot of that going on. But
I mean, I was just looking at the Grace Meng. Sorry, Grace Meng in particular, because I just endorsed her challenger. I couldn't believe what really drew me in was she's a vice chair of the Democratic Party, DNC, and she votes more to the right than existing Republicans. And she's representing the most diverse district in the country. In Queens.
That's and you know, Meeks is another guy.
Yep. Oh yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of that. And but we'll talk a little bit more about that in the fun half. Also, don't forget, check out the Antifada. We got a lot of things happening. Jamie's going to be gone this weekend, so head over and check out what they've got offered. She's got a lot of stuff she mentioned yesterday. And of course, Literary Hangover, their new Twitch stream is burning up the interwebs. Isn't that right, Matt?
Yeah, it definitely is. I played Red Dead last night, and we learned about how the managerial revolution happened on the Wild West after the Civil War. So it was desperados and outlaws, and then the managers came and sewed things up for the trains and basically those sorts of interests.
It's not Friday, but let me recommend, Matt, I presume you've watched this movie, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
My dad probably has. I was never a big Western guy.
Dude, check it out. That's the story of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Oh, cool.
Bob,
all right.
Bob Dylan did the soundtrack for that.
Well, he was in the movie, too.
Whole record, yeah.
The only Western I've seen.
On Heaven's Door came from.
Yes, it did.
Have you seen The Searchers, Sam?
Yeah, I've seen The Searchers. That's not what I'm talking about. All right. And the point is that I am telling you, it is very in tune with what you're talking about. It's first
I'll
of all,
check
Peckinpah.
It out.
It's Peckinpah.
Oh, nice. I know what that means.
You know what Peckinpah means?
Yeah, ultraviolet, right?
Well, no, not ultraviolet. I mean, no. It's a little bit. It's a little bit violent, but it's not gory in any way. But it talks about what that dynamic in the West. All right, whatever.
No, I'm totally intrigued.
Wait, the only thing I can add was
what is that about?
I just never really got into Westerns because I'm from North Dakota, so it just seemed like I don't know, like.
I think actually
too close to home,
in the Dakotas.
That's the problem. I didn't see Fargo until I moved to New York either.
That's hysterical.
I think this Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid takes place in the Dakotas. All right. Huh. Whatever. I'll have your dad. I'll talk about it with your dad. Like, folks, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number we have. Also, I will set up the IM machine right now as we speak. And see you in the fun half. Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.